The two-time Tony Award-winning hit follows Johnny, Toonie, and Will as they flee the constraints of their hometown for the thrills of the city life in this energy-filled rock opera. That's American Idiot, June 9th through July 2nd at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for another special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. Once again, we'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival, with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and the participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive and entertaining festival. Again, be sure to tune in on Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for our What the Festival broadcast. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Check it out, baby.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Debtors Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st at 4 p.m. under the bridge at Cathedral Park in Portland. Strike Debt is a nationwide movement of debt resistors fighting for economic justice and democratic freedom. This event also features a Strike Debt Portland potluck. Again, that's the Debtors Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st, 4 to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Tuesday, June 14th, 2016, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, real radio for real people at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Before we speak with our guest, first a brief run through the weather. Today, showers, thunderstorms possible later in the day, and highs around 60, and a southwest wind 9 to 11. Tonight, again, exactly the same thing. It'll be a little bit of drizzle just to put you in the mood, and then bam-o, possibly a thunderstorm. Everybody, let's just hope for that to happen. It's certainly something we need. I need, let's say it that way. And those around 46. And a southwest wind 6 to 11. Tomorrow, look for a slight chance of rain. And otherwise, you could get a bit of sun breaking through and a high near 63, not much in the way of wind. And for tomorrow night, that chance of showers tapering off. Otherwise, overcast and low around 48. And again, 6 to 11 mile per hour winds. That's about it for the weather. We have some updates and some big news from Coos County, from Coos Bay. Jody McCaffrey will be talking a bit about developments in the struggle to prevent any development at Jordan Cove, any terminals. It is every aspect of the Jordan Cove terminal is full of difficulties and possible illegalities from the super tankers that would be coming into the bay, from the Pacific Connector pipelines, and as well as trucks and so forth coming in. building the additional stress on the carrying capacity of the land. And now, of course, OSHA, if any trains are involved, the OSHA problems are going to crop up. Jody, we're also going to be speaking today. We tried yesterday to speak with Charlotte Nielsen and Hilo Hancock with the Coeur d'Alene people who have made this massively big, beautiful canoe, and they're bringing it down the river. This is all in the name of doing something on behalf of salmon above Grand Coulee Dam. Google Grand Coulee Dam and see what it looks like if you don't already have a mental image. It is a massive, massive thing sitting in the middle of the landscape, visible from space. In fact, looks like it was built by something from space, and we never speak about it. And hopefully it's too big to fail. And we all know where that got us. So we'll be speaking with people who are in a canoe that is in the name of restoring habitat to the people and the creatures of the region. And now we speak with Jody McCaffrey. Good morning, Jody, and welcome back once again to KBOO Developments down there. I heard a story on... Well, as I flip through various news sources on the radio, the so-called, I guess, public radio mainstream announced that activism and pressure from the anti-LNG camp is what prompted officials to extend a deadline. And that's not, however, the story that you heard.
The notice that I was given was that they wanted, the Department of State Lands wanted more time to consider these outstanding issues they had with wetland delineation for the pipeline, fish passage for pipeline crossings, and wetland and waterway impacts and mitigation. I kind of think that because they're extending it, you know, to pass the election, they don't want this decision influencing or having... an influence with the election. That's my take on it. Because I think they have enough evidence right now to deny this permit. There's no question that Jordan Cove doesn't meet the criteria. But I don't know how they'll get around that. You know, I'm sure that the industry will try to mitigate or do something to explain how they can, you know, justify their project. But it's still, there's rules. And if you don't fit the rules, you shouldn't be given a permit. That's the bottom line. But that isn't the way that we've had to process our permits. The rules seem clear to us, but somehow, you know, when the money gets involved, the rules kind of get skirted around, or they find some reasoning to say that they can do that anyway.
Well, all these projects seem, it seems that all of the projects are launched on the understanding that whatever laws, existing law, prevents the construction of this thing, that those will be, in the end, that there will be a way around. Those laws will be obliterated or changed in on behalf of the corporate interest. And we've got foreign companies building a terminal that would not in any way benefit Americans. The natural gas would be shipped overseas. So it's no benefit whatsoever coming or going. And it is at a great, great risk, because there is wetland delineation for the pipeline. Okay, that's subtle and it's complex. There are wetland, the whole length of the pipeline is riddled with wetlands. Secondly, fish passage for pipeline crossing, because there's no way that can happen successfully. It just is not possible without building a huge network of roads and so forth to support fish crossings. And the impacts and mitigation with regard to the wetland and the waterway, they are... not feasible. So none of this is possible. We do have existing laws, but it seems that they're just waiting for the Trans-Pacific Partnership to pass, which would give these Star Chamber courts the right to issue the permits. Can you talk a bit more about some of the meetings coming up and what this extra time is going to, how this is going to be used?
Well, we just got notification that on July 8th at 1 p.m. in the North Bend, there's going to be a hearing on the Jordan Cove man camp. That's they're saying that it's a worker camp that's not related to Jordan Cove. That's how they're saying they justifying processing this. We appealed this. It was a planning decision that 32 citizens appealed in October, and it's gone through a process, but now it's going to be a hearing before a hearings officer the July 8th, and we could absolutely use people looking at the record and adding comments and attending that hearing. That would be great. It's kind of like, I don't really understand this, because what FERC issued was, they issued an order that denied Jordan Cove, and the order is not stayed. In other words, it's not set aside why we process other permits. It's a final decision. Although FERC's kind of, you can comment to FERC, and they'll kind of, those are going into a record. I don't know in the end if they'll accept those comments totally, but it seems crazy, because there is a IEA report that just came out that clearly showed there's no market. There's no market. There's all these projects that are under construction that will be coming online in the next 5 years, and they're going to be adding like a 45% increase in liquefaction capacity. And at the same time, the market has kind of weakened, especially for Japan and Korea. They're not using as much gas, not as much as they predicted. So there's this glut of LNG. So why would you come to Oregon and build a terminal, a 232-mile pipeline through 400 water bodies, all this destruction for a project that really isn't needed?
Again,
and
400
to be needed.
400 water bodies.
Yeah.
That's these are numbers that I don't think the public, and even some of our listeners, it's very difficult to really comprehend what this project means. And again, it's been soundly rejected all up and down the coast. Mexico, California, Washington. Oregon is the only state left where the officials are even contemplating permitting this thing. That's what is troubling to me. It seems that Oregon's green image is not upheld by the facts of the matter. That's, again, something that I wonder if...
I think it's sold as jobs, but people need to understand, when you go start being destructive to salmon-bearing streams and you start being destructive to our estuary that harms oyster companies, you're actually stifling jobs. You're actually causing detriment to jobs that are sustainable jobs. And in the end, this project is not the jobs people think it is. It's like 140 jobs. That's what they're saying. And that's like maybe a large grocery store. I mean, that's not the kind of jobs that is actually needed, and it's actually probably going to be a job negative if you consider all the negative jobs that will occur, not just from the destruction of the water bodies and the estuary, but when you export our natural resource, you're going to cause the price of that to go up, and that's a negative to businesses that use natural gas. So it's a negative all the way around. I just don't understand the trade unions, you know, that don't understand that it's not in the end a benefit to them.
And the other thing too, I wondered about. One final question is: in the case of these huge companies, Walmart notably, and others, they paid, you know, low paid jobs, very bad jobs, and the only reason that they're there at all is because they can't be outsourced, and yet all the profits do not accrue to the state. They are shipped out of state. Sometimes, and it's not in the case of Walmart, but in some cases, profits are shipped overseas or to Canada. So there is no net benefit to the state whatsoever. With regard to Jordan Cove, can you speak, just in the last few seconds, we have some of the companies involved and where they are headquartered?
You mean the company behind Jordan Cove?
Yes, there are a number of companies.
It's Verathon, which is a Canadian company, and at one time I'm not sure currently, but you could not even invest in it unless you were Canadian. So this is not for Americans. This is for the whole purpose of Jordan Cove was to export Canadian gas because they had trouble building a pipeline up in Canada to get it, gas exported up there.
So and they, nobody wanted it, and they didn't want to use Canadian shores. Coastline for anything like this.
Right.
So, Jody, thank you so much. We are completely flat out of time. This is important. The reason why we talk about it so much is because it is terribly important to all of us. If we call Cascadia our home, whether we are long-time residents, whether we're born here, or that we arrived last week. Nonetheless, this is Cascadia, and if you're here, then Jordan Cove is your issue. Thanks so much again, Jody. This has been Cascadia for Tuesday, June 14th, 2016. Engineering for us today, as every Tuesday, Janet Anderson. Thanks, Janet. Kathleen Stevenson. It's the KBOO AM News Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Producing a radio program in the immediate wake of a massacre is my least favorite type of show to do. There's the obvious tragedy itself, that is tragic, and it's also emotionally charging. Then the public discourse and debate takes an all too familiar form. Old arguments about the rights to a gun, what does the Second Amendment mean, and discussions of mental health and a violent culture arise once again. If the person who conducted the killing spree is Muslim, well then we talk about terrorism, what causes terrorism, Islamophobia, and whether it should be called terrorism at all and not a hate crime. If the victims are gay, well, then it does become about hate crimes and about homophobia. All this arises and then fades again until another massacre happens. Unlike other horrific gun-related mass shootings, though, in this country, the massacre in which 50 people at least have died in Orlando on early Sunday morning at a popular gay club is going to mix all of these strands together. So in trying to approach this, I reached out to a man I interviewed several years ago and who lives within many of these currents. His name is Parvez Sharma, and he's a gay Muslim filmmaker. In 2007, he directed the film A Jihad for Love, which was about him coming out as a gay man. His latest film, released just last year, is called A Sinner in Mecca, and it's about his trip, his Hajj, to Mecca, which is an important element in being a Muslim. I spoke to him a couple of hours ago. Parvez Sharma, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
First, what's your reaction to what has happened in Orlando?
I am devastated, and I cannot believe it's true, but unfortunately it is. Part of me thinks that I should not be surprised just because ISIS over the last few months has increased its attacks, if you will, on homosexuality and on gay people. Moderate Muslims like me, people who go around saying that gay Muslims can be acceptable, we need to stop hiding behind our barriers, you know, saying that Islam is a religion of peace. I think that's too simplistic, and that is not true. And yesterday's incident proves it.
How significant is it to you that Omar Mateen was Muslim?
It goes to the very core of my identity of who I am. But it's surprising. Yesterday when I woke up, my husband had woken up before me, and he told me this had happened, and it was a Sunday. And I said, please don't tell me, but I'm sure his name is going to be Muslim. He said they haven't released it yet. But within an hour, we knew it was Muslim. I had a premonition as soon as I learned about it that it had to be Muslim.
What does the Quran say about homosexuality?
The Quran says pretty much the same thing that the Jewish Bible, that's the Old Testament, and the New Testament or the New Bible say for Christians and Jews, which is the story of Lot or the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. So like them, it is uniquely silent on the modern idea of how we see homosexuality. However, you can go to any mosque in any corner of the Muslim world where Saudi influence has penetrated, and you can hear hate rhetoric on command from whichever imam sits there. And that is a reality that Muslims have to also face.
Your latest film, again, is called A Sinner in Mecca, and you can watch it on Netflix. I saw it last night. It was a very beautiful film.
Thank you. Yeah.
Tell me more about Saudi Arabia, and do you see a connection with Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism, and what happened yesterday?
A very strong connection, indeed, because Wahhabi ideology, and let's not make this too technical, so I just try to say it as simply as I can. Wahhabi ideology comes from an 18th century pact between a struggling cleric and the head of the Ibn Saud family at the time. This ideology has penetrated and spread through the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for two centuries and is now the law of the land in terms of Sharia law. This is an Islam of intolerance, and it's an Islam of violence. The problem is that 1.6 billion of us Muslims have allowed the Wahhabis to spread this ideology into all corners of the Muslim world. And we are not standing up and taking responsibility for that, because part and parcel of that ideology is this homophobia against Muslims. It's just part and parcel of it.
Homosexuals are executed in Saudi Arabia?
Yes.
Is that common?
It's found out. It is very common, indeed. But the Sharia application of the law makes it a little more complicated because you need to have four witnesses. What will happen at the very least if you are found out to be gay is that you will get a long prison sentence and public lashes. What will happen at the worst is death by beheading. And unfortunately, that has happened in more cases than you can imagine.
Again, Parvez Sharma, you are a gay Muslim. You're just not a gay man from the Muslim world, but you are a believer as well. How do you see, personally, spiritually, Islam and homosexuality?
I've had a hard time reconciling the two. I always have. My previous film, A Jihad for Love, was really about me coming out as a gay man. This film was about coming out as a Muslim, and it's called A Sinner in Mecca for a reason, because the idea of homosexuality within Islam is all about sin. And I have looked hard for affirmation within the Quran, and I have not found it. And others may challenge me, but that is exactly what my opinion is.
In A Sinner in Mecca, there's this very fascinating moment where you're looking at the Kaaba. And while you're looking at it, you say this: the direction I have faced all of my life, here it is.
And indeed, there it is. I have accepted Islam, as I say in the film, that it's no longer a question of whether Islam will accept me. The question is whether I, as a gay Muslim, will accept Islam. And I have, but I've done it on my own terms. And one of those terms is my homosexuality, which I'm proud of, and which unfortunately is one of the reasons why a majority of Muslims around the world would condemn me. So homophobia is not new to Islam. It's something that's been going on for a long time, for centuries.
Parvez Sharma, you were once a producer at Democracy Now, so you're very familiar. And I think
they wanted to have me on this morning, but I'm not in New York at the moment. Yeah.
And I'm sure you will be on there. And I'm very happy to be talking to you over the telephone. A little easier for us because we could have you on the phone. But I wonder if when we talk about Islam And when we say that, to say that it's only a religion of peace is untrue. And I know you're very familiar with issues of Islamophobia as well, along with homophobia. But Islamophobia, do you worry that that sentiment can be used in more surveillance or war or these things that we've seen over the past two decades?
You know, I'm making a really simple statement here. I'm not going out challenging anybody. What I'm saying is that, for example, us in the left, which would include non-Muslims, should stop saying Islam is a religion of peace, because it's not. Of course, this is a time of intense Islamophobia, and it is absolutely fashionable to be Islamophobic in Donald Trump's America. So that is clear, and that backlash is going to happen, and this is going to become a part of the election cycle, definitely. There's no question about it. What is really interesting to me is that this places the right wing in this country in a very challenging place. They condemn both Islam and homosexuality, correct? Yeah. But now you have the two things coming together in the most horrific of ways possible. So what is the right wing going to do?
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, and as you indicated, these two things have come together many times around the world, but this is the first time I think we're directly looking at it here in the United States.
Anywhere in the world, this is the worst attack in history to happen, not just on U.S. soil, but to the gay community anywhere in the world. This is enormous.
Do you worry about a backlash against the Muslim community here in the United States?
Absolutely. But again, I accept it, cynically perhaps, but I don't have a choice. When barbarism like this happens, how do you react to it?
Parvesh,
especially if your identity of being gay and Muslim is at the center of all of this, you know? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, covering mass shootings the next day are the shows I don't like to do very much. Not just because of the tragedy, but oftentimes the discourse over it is the same again and again, and it happens again and again and again. But I have to admit, in emailing you, and we had you in studio a number of years ago to talk about A Jihad for Love, and I enjoyed that very much. But in emailing you, I felt uncomfortable because I felt like I was saying, hey, you're gay and Muslim. A Muslim just killed a bunch of gay people. You want to come on and talk about it? This must put you in a difficult situation.
You bet, exactly. Yeah. And I can understand the position that places you in. And there's going to be many debates about this. There's going to be talk of gun violence again in the country. But the biggest thing that's going to come out of this is that it's going to be a big discussion point in this climate of hatred that we have in America right now, in any case, that is created by the right wing. And because this goes to both the gays and the Muslims that they hate equally, it's going to place them in a very strange place indeed.
Center for Mecca, again, this is your newest film, just came out in the fall last year, I believe. It's on Netflix. I watched it last night in preparing for our conversation. It was beautiful in part because you had, and it was all done on your cell phone, I believe,
yes.
At least most of
yes.
it. But you're not.
The majority of it, yeah, 95% of the film.
Yeah, you're not allowed to film a Hajj, are you? A trip like this.
Well, technically you're not, but the Saudis have given up in the 21st century because, you know, there's 4 million people coming into Mecca during Hajj season, and the majority of them are carrying smartphones, and a lot of them are going to want to take Hajj selfies with the Kaaba in the background. So it's very hard for them to enforce this idea of this idea of why the human form is not depictable in Islam.
Parvez Sharma, I thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Again, Parvez Sharma is a filmmaker. He is also a gay Muslim. His latest film, just out last fall, that could be found on Netflix, is called A Sinner in Mecca. In 2007, he directed the documentary film Jihad for Love. This is Letters on Politics on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mitch Jezrich. And this is a quote from my guest, law professor David Cole, in his book Engines of Liberty. In 1990, then-retired Chief Justice Warren Burger, a conservative Republican, dismissed the idea that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to bear arms as, quote, one of the greatest pieces of fraud, I repeat the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups I have ever seen in my lifetime, end quote. In 1996, conservative judge and scholar Robert Bork similarly contended that the Second Amendment protected only state rights, not individual rights. But in 2008, the District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court officially endorsed the right that Hammer and the NRA had been defending for almost 40 years and ruled that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to bear arms. Again, that's a quote from David Cole's new book. David Cole is the honorary George J. Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy at Georgetown University. And the name of the book is Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. David Cole joins me from Washington, D.C. over the telephone. David Cole, it's my good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I mentioned a couple names in there, one being Hammer. That's Marion Hammer. And we'll talk about her story here in a moment. But fascinating to think back in 1990, former Supreme Court justice, and he was retired at the time, though, but still a conservative, Warren Burger, and even Robert Bork had very different ideas about what the Second Amendment meant than we have ever since 2008 in the legal realm.
Well, that's right. And for over 100 years, the federal courts agreed with Justice Burger and Judge Bork that the Second Amendment protected really only the state's prerogative to maintain militias, which were initially thought to be a kind of protection against federal tyranny, and not individuals' right to own or possess guns in their own home for their own private purposes. But that all changed in 2008, and the argument of my book is that the reason that changed was not so much that there were particular justices on the court who were imposing their personal views on the American people, but the NRA undertook a 40-year campaign to shift our understanding of the Second Amendment. And it's really due to the NRA more than the Supreme Court that the Constitution today protects an individual right to bear arms, for better or for worse.
And it's fascinating. If you look at the history of the NRA, it also has a very diverse history, one that you would not expect over the last 40 years if you look at it in the long term. I mean, the NRA dates back, what, to just after the Civil War?
Right. It was founded by Union generals, a couple of Union generals, who were just astounded at how bad shots their men were in the Civil War, and they felt like there's a real need to train people up so that they can, you know, hit the side of a barn door, and that was what the NRA was created to do, to be a marksmanship organization, and it became a hunting organization and a sport shooting organization and a gun safety organization, but it wasn't a political organization until 1975 was the first time that it created a political arm, the lobbying office of the NRA. And in 1977, as part of a kind of popular revolt within the NRA turned its attention to establishing an individual right to bear arms as a constitutional matter.
What more can you tell me about that popular revolt inside?
Well, there was a real disagreement within the NRA. So they had created, in 1975, they created this lobbying office in Washington. That was a first step towards sort of politicization, but there were real doubts about that. And the leadership was, in 76, 77, fired a number of the people in the lobbying office had decided to close down their Washington office and move their national office from Virginia, which is just outside of Washington, to out to Colorado. And the idea was they really, you know, wanted to get out of politics. They wanted to focus on all the other things that the NRA does. And it wasn't, it was in 1977 at the NRA convention in Cincinnati, a group of sort of hardcore gun supporters sort of took control through the democratic process within the NRA, voted out the sort of moderate leadership, voted in a leadership that cared deeply about the right to bear arms, changed the bylaws of the NRA so that the commitment to the individual right to bear arms was number one in their self-definition. And it's really then that they began this campaign, which, you know, culminates in the 2008 Supreme Court decision recognizing an individual right to bear arms, and you know, culminates in the reality we see today, which is that even after horrific events like the Orlando massacre or the Sandy Hook massacre or the San Bernardino massacre, virtually nothing is done to put limits on guns. Why? Because the NRA is sufficiently strong and has sufficient democratic support and popular support in the public and among their membership that they can stop gun control laws from being enacted.
This issue of popular support, and again, you called what happened in the 1970s to the NRA a popular revolt. I know I've in the past have called it a hostile takeover, but you're right. I mean, there is public support for what the NRA has become and what it's still doing today by its own membership.
That's right. And so the point of my book is that is where constitutional rights lie. They lie not in the decisions of courts so much as in the sort of democratic engagement of associations of like-minded citizens pressing for the rights they care about. And the NRA is a very, very strong example of this. They understand the democratic roots of constitutional rights. And I think even after they prevailed in the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court recognized a right to bear arms, it's really the NRA, more than the court, that protects the right to bear arms. It's the NRA, not the court, that stops, for example, Congress from enacting a universal background check after the Sandy Hook massacre happened, even when, you know, a vast number of people in America in polls said they supported it. They're just very, very powerful at protecting their rights. And this is a book about, it's not a book specifically about the NRA, it's a book about the democratic roots of constitutional rights. And so I take three stories of organizations and groups that have succeeded in changing the landscape of our constitutional law, and look at how they did it. So the NRA is one in changing it in the conservative direction. The other two are marriage equality, changing it in a liberal direction, and the human rights pushback to President Bush in the war on terror, also changing practice in a constitutional practice and law in a liberal direction. So it doesn't go in one direction or the other, but the point of the book is that constitutional law comes from the ground up through the organized, committed activities of groups like the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the NRA, Lambda Legal Defense, and the like.
And we'll get to marriage and then also the Center for Constitutional Rights. And you write a lot about Michael Ratner, who recently passed away. Let's just stay for a moment. Let's stick with the NRA here for a moment. So much of this goes back to what happened in the 1960s after we had a slew of political assassinations. John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X. This is when we really start to get some stringent gun laws.
Right. Well, and at the federal level in particular, 1968 Gun Control Act was really the first major piece of federal law regulating and limiting the sale and possession of guns. And it was that act, which was, as you say, sparked by these assassinations, that really sort of ginned up the NRA and those within the NRA who were concerned about the right to bear arms. And so, you know, on the one hand, 68 marks the high water mark of federal gun control legislation. At the same time, it is what sparks the NRA to launch its campaign to change constitutional law to effectuate an individual right to bear arms.
Who is Marion Hammer? And you met her. You interviewed her for this book.
Yeah. I interviewed a lot of people for this book because, again, this is a book about the power of citizens organized together to make constitutional law. So I wanted to talk to the citizens who made a difference. Marion Hammer is one such citizen. She's a woman now in her 70s. She's about 4'11". She never went to law school. She grew up with her grandfather on a farm, teaching her how to hunt rabbits. And after the 68 Gun Control Act, she'd never been political before that. She becomes politicized, and she decides to fight for the right to bear arms, which she sees as under attack. Today, she is the most powerful lobbyist in Florida. And Florida is the sort of ground zero for all of the NRA's state-based campaigns to protect gun rights. They start in Florida, so much so, and because Marion Hammer is so powerful. She's also the first female president of the NRA. But Florida is so sympathetic to gun rights laws that it's often called the Gunshine State, Sunshine State. Now we'll see whether that changes with this horrific attack in Orlando. But you know, we've had a lot of these mass shootings. President Obama has made 14 statements during his tenure after mass shootings. That's just during his tenure. We've had a lot of them. And the political calculus hasn't really yet changed. And I doubt it's going to change in Florida. So she was really the front for the NRA's lobbying campaigns, which started in Florida, and then they would pass a law there, say on concealed carry laws or stand your ground laws or gun manufacturer immunity laws, and then they'd take them to Alabama, and then they'd take them to the next state and the next state and the next state. And they really proceeded on a state-based strategy because federal law was against them. Go back to, you know, what Chief Justice Berger and Robert Bork said, there is no constitutional right to bear arms. So what they did was they worked at the state level to develop a state-based right to bear arms. And after all, that's where most gun laws are passed, at the state level, not at the federal level. And while the gun control folks were sort of focused on Washington, the NRA was out in the states, and they have affiliates in every state passing all these laws. So that by the time the question came to the Supreme Court in 2008, should there be a federal constitutional right to bear arms, virtually every state already recognized an individual right to bear arms.
And that affects the Supreme Court.
Well, right. It
this
makes
isn't
it much
just
easier
the
for the Supreme Court to recognize a constitutional right because it's not imposing something new on the states. It's essentially reaffirming what's already out there.
I mean, that was a very similar dynamic that we saw in the movement for same-gender marriage.
Exactly. Now, they didn't start in Florida.
No.
but they, too. You know, So early on, people filed cases, and some gay couples filed cases in federal court or arguing that they had a right to marry. In 1972, one of those cases went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court dismissed it with a single sentence. This doesn't even present a serious question. We're not even going to take it up. 2015, the Supreme Court recognizes a right to marriage equality. The arguments didn't change from 1972 to 2015. The court, if anything, the court in 2015 was a more conservative court than the court in 1972, which was sort of the last days of the Warren Court. What changed was the world changed. And what I show in the book is, how did the world change? How did gay rights groups make that transition so that arguments which were rejected as not even presenting a serious question were virtually inevitable when it went up to the court in 2015. And they, like the NRA, they focused on the states. They tended to focus start in New England. They, like the NRA, engaged in incremental reforms that were designed to sort of develop the norm of recognizing that gay couples can be a family. So they first changed family laws to allow for adoption by gay couples. They then sought limited domestic partnership benefits from sympathetic corporations, from some towns and progressive towns and cities, ultimately from some states. Then they expanded those. They sought non-discrimination and hate crimes legislation to be expanded to include animus against gays. And then only then, after they'd made all that progress, did they file a case. In this one was in Vermont. They started in Vermont, arguing that the Vermont state constitution gave them a right to marry on the same terms as heterosexual couples. And they did not make a federal constitutional argument because they wanted to keep it away from the Supreme Court. They didn't feel like the Supreme Court was ready to take this on in, you know, in 1999. And so they only made arguments based on state law. And they got civil unions, which was not quite marriage, but close in Vermont. But then they took that same strategy to Massachusetts, where they got the first court decision, again, on state constitutional law grounds, recognizing marriage equality. And that then they then took that victory to Connecticut, to Iowa, to California, as you know, and eventually gained sufficient momentum in these state constitutional law arguments that the issue could sort of jump the tracks and be recognized in under federal constitutional law.
Again, we're in conversation with David Cole. He is the honorary George J. Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy at Georgetown University Law Center. He's the author of the book, Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. For our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, David Cole will actually be in town tomorrow, Tuesday, in San Francisco, speaking at the Kiker and Van Est Law Firms. That's at 633 Battery Street in San Francisco, starting at 5:30 p.m. We'll give those details again as we wrap up this conversation. David Cole, looking back at Florida and the issue concerning concerning guns, again, you interviewed Marion Hammer. You interviewed a number of people with the NRA. Did you talk to them about their feelings about such assault weapons like the AR-15 that was used yesterday?
I did. And they, and you know, and their view on assault weapons is that it's a very minor part of the problem of gun violence and gun homicides. The vast majority of gun violence and gun homicides are committed with ordinary handguns, not assault weapons. That's number one. Number two, they take the position that, you know, it's actually really difficult to define an assault weapon. So what is it that makes a weapon an assault weapon? Well, one thing that makes an assault weapon is that it's semi-automatic, which means every time you pull the trigger, it fires a bullet and it automatically reloads. And that's why this guy was able to kill 50 people with one gun in the Florida nightclub. But that's true of virtually all guns made in America today. It's not just assault weapons that are semi-automatic. It's virtually all guns that are semi-automatic. So you can't ban all semi-automatics or you'd be banning all guns. That's their position. And so when Congress sought to ban assault weapons in 1994, they did. What they did was they defined assault weapons by their sort of cosmetics. Were they sort of a military style? And that was turned out to be completely useless because it was very easy for manufacturers to just alter the style slightly. And it's obviously not the style that makes the gun potent; it's the power. And so the assault weapon ban, which was in existence for 10 years, did virtually nothing to reduce gun crime in the United States. Did virtually nothing to ban assault weapons. It did have the effect of turning the House of Representatives from Democratic control to Republican control in the following election because of the backlash for the first time in 40 years. But it did virtually nothing to really respond to the problem of gun violence.
So that turned the House?
Yeah, it was in 1994. The gun law was assault weapon ban enacted in 1994. The NRA made it a huge issue in the midterms. They targeted a number of House members who had voted for the assault weapon ban, and enough of them were defeated that the House turned Republican at that point. And Bill Clinton, actually, in his autobiography, says the NRA won that night.
Hmm. When you talk to Marion Hammer and other people of the NRA, you would ask them, and again, the perspective of your book is that how these people, and not just the NRA, but also advocates for same-gender marriage, how they changed constitutional law through their actions. And they didn't agree with that approach. They saw it as already just enforcing a constitutional law.
Right. Yeah. The NRA folks looked at me kind of funny when I talked about sort of the thesis of my book, because they said, change constitutional law. We're not changing constitutional law. We're just restoring constitutional law. We're restoring it to what the original understanding was. And, you know, that's their view. Many of the NRA members' view of constitutional law is sort of in keeping with the late Justice Scalia's view, that it should be interpreted in keeping with the original intent of the people who signed it, way back when. And so they don't, so the notion that they're changing constitutional law is sort of anathema to them. But what I show in the book is that, you know, change, restore, that's semantics. The reality is that for 100 years, the law was there is no individual right to bear arms at the federal constitutional level. The NRA took that on. They took it on through a variety of tactics in the states, as we've talked about, in the law schools. They supported scholarship that argued the opposite. In the executive branch, when Bush was elected and he appointed John Ashcroft as Attorney General, they got Ashcroft, who was a longtime NRA member, to reverse the Justice Department's longtime stand that the Second Amendment doesn't protect an individual right to bear arms, and he said it does. And they got Congress to enact a couple of statutes that endorse the notion of an individual right to bear arms, all before the Supreme Court took up the question. And that's why in 2008, when the Supreme Court took up the question, it was able to reverse essentially 100 years of precedent and recognize an individual right to bear arms. So whether you call it changing or restoring, the reality is that constitutional law changes and develops over time. And the point of this book is that the way it develops is through our actions, through the actions of citizens. You might say Citizens United, if somebody hadn't already taken that term, but citizens organized together in behind a particular idea, whether that idea is marriage equality, or whether that idea is free speech or labor rights, or the right to bear arms, or the right against torture. The way you change constitutional law is through organized advocacy over the long term. And so civil society groups are a critical part of how constitutional law operates in this country. It's not just the courts and separation of powers, these formal elements of government that enforce constitutional law. It's us as citizens when we get engaged through these kinds of organizations.
Well, speaking of Citizens United then, and it's not a case that you made a huge part of your argument in your book, but could you say with the decision over Citizens United in 2010 that it has the same dynamic behind it?
Absolutely. There's been a concerted campaign led largely by the Republican Party to change the law on campaign finance towards a view that any restriction on campaign spending is presumptively unconstitutional. And that has been succeeding in the last 10, 15 years quite dramatically. However, I think that's one of the ripe areas where Citizens United can effectively reverse Citizens United, the decision, because that decision is widely unpopular. Polls say that something like 80% of Americans think the case was wrongly decided, and 70% of Republicans think it was wrongly decided. The fact that Trump, Bernie, and Hillary have all made the problem of money in politics a central part of their campaigns suggests that there's strong popular support. And there are important civil society organizations out there working to effectuate reform on campaign finance. And I would not be at all surprised if in the next 10 to 20 years, Citizens United is overturned and courts are legislatures are permitted broader leeway to rein in the distorting effects of money in our electoral system, in our democracy. But that will only happen if citizens unite in furtherance of that goal.
And Citizens United challenges to it are, you'd say, are much more ripe now, much more ripe than, say, gun laws?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, things, right, I think they're very ripe because, I would say more ripe than gun rights because there is already substantial consensus that there's something wrong. And so if organized groups can show a way forward, it's very likely that the courts will recognize a broader range of legitimate interests that justify regulating campaign finance. Gun laws, you know, it's possible. There's also a substantial citizens' movement on gun laws, on gun control in particular. Mayor Bloomberg's organization, which is called Every Town for Gun Safety, is in some ways modeled on the NRA. It's not Washington focused as the Brady Center and the other gun control groups have been. It's more dispersed. He got mayors in lots of cities around the country to sign on, and it's designed to have affiliates around the country and to operate at the local level, not just at the national level. And, you know, I think people are, if you look at the media, there's increasing reports on the toll that gun violence is having on our citizens, particularly in the inner cities, these mass shootings. It's possible that the politics will change there. But the NRA has a very, very strong head start. They have 5 million members. They have their members are very, very active and very, very committed, and they have been focused on this issue in a sort of laser-like way for a very long time. So tough to fight that.
David Cole, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Again, David Cole has been our guest. He is the Honorary George J. Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy at Georgetown University Law Center. He's the author of the book Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. And that does it for Letters in Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is the engineer. You can find our archives at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. The time is 10:57. The KBOO Evening News produces a one-hour newscast every weeknight. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge, but you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. Email Lisa Loving at newsdirector@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 203. Coming up at 11, Stage and Studio presents a documentary produced by David Freudberg telling the moving story of Tucker Stilley, who in his early 40s was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, a degenerative condition that leads to paralysis and frequently claims the patient's life. And at 11:30, Andre Middleton hosts Art Focus. His guests are local artists Mia O'Connor and Natalie Figueroa. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2016 Juneteenth Oregon Celebration, Saturday, June 18th. The Clara People's Freedom Trail Parade begins at 10:45 a.m. starting on Northeast 8th and Jarrett, continuing south on Martin Luther King Boulevard and west on Russell. It will end at the Juneteenth Oregon Celebration at Legacy Emmanuel Field at Northeast Graham in Vancouver at noon. The celebration will be from noon to 7 p.m. and feature family fun and activities, community vendors, music and other live entertainment, and much, much more. Again, that's the 2016 Juneteenth Oregon Celebration, Saturday, June 18th, with the parade from 10:45 to noon and the celebration from noon to 7 p.m. at Legacy Emmanuel Field at Northeast Graham in Vancouver and Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund and the Network Incorporated.
You really trust Tucker now to always lead the way, where you would think if somebody was sick that they would sort of retreat and you would then have to take over for him. He is always leading the way on how he's going to do this, how he's going to eat, how he's going to breathe. He's always got strategies, and he always has a sense of humor. So I'm amazed.
Against the impossible limitations of Lou Gehrig's disease, a truly creative spirit rallies with support from loved ones. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. The thing about having ALS, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, known as Lou Gehrig's disease, is that your mental awareness remains intact, may even be heightened. Meanwhile, the functions of your body, the ability to move your limbs, to walk, to talk, in some cases to swallow properly, collapse one by one. Your nervous system is breaking down. Your muscles are wasting, and now, in a wheelchair, you're watching this implosion in slow motion as you become paralyzed and most likely die within a few years. They've discovered the defective gene, but medical science doesn't yet know how to stop ALS. This is the story of a truly remarkable spirit, a light-hearted, brilliant film editor, musician, and artist near Los Angeles named Tucker Stilley. His wife, also a film editor, is Lindsay Mofford.
Tucker's a great, great string instrument player. And Tucker was trying to play the mandolin, and his fingers weren't working, and he thought maybe he had been on the computer too much. Then he started falling a lot, and we thought it was an old football injury. And we both are terrible about going to doctors. Ugh. But he started feeling this numbness all over the place. But we still thought, eh. And it was our daughter, who wasn't even five yet. She was like 4 and a half. She said, oh, that's my daddy. He falls down a lot. And that's when we suddenly realized, oh, my goodness.
The diagnosis of ALS was confirmed by doctors in 2005 when Tucker was 43. Medical costs would be relatively modest because there's no effective treatment. The outlook was bleak, a downward spiral that would increasingly limit his career and would ultimately threaten his life. As use of his hands worsened, Tucker, who had always been computer savvy, tried out different voice recognition programs that would translate his spoken words into text on a screen. But even that became problematic as his voice deteriorated too. In this recording, the impairment causes Tucker to slur his words.
He keeps looking at me like, hey, you're not the guy you said you were. You're not pronouncing stuff that we did yesterday. Because my voice is, you would laugh. I will barely be able to talk. And then it comes right back, and I'm almost as good as ever. Right now, I'm at this very moment, I'm sort of like 40%.
What are you looking for?
The other end of the cord.
Oh, come on.
Stupidly, Friends and family of Tucker Stilley fuss with various cords and tubes extending from a rack of medical devices next to his wheelchair in his living room in the Los Angeles suburb of San Marino. They help him to breathe, eat, and clear his lungs. With an oxygen mask on his face, he sits wrapped in a blanket by the fireplace where a log is burning on a coolish Southern California Sunday afternoon. A small reflective dot is attached to Tucker's forehead. A special camera fixed to the laptop computer in front of him detects the location of the dot. When Tucker pivots his head, it shifts the location of the cursor on the screen. Through subtle neck movements, he can control an on-screen keyboard to type words, which in turn are pronounced by a synthesized voice he has selected, in this case a female voice. At the moment, Tucker's breathing tube has gotten tangled.
My air hose is snagged on something.
Tucker's younger brother, Philip, untangles the hose.
Thanks a billion.
I always say, welcome a trillion.
That's Tucker's dad, Hugh Stilley, a professor of technical writing at Kettering University in Flint, Michigan. He has moved to L.A. to help care for his son.
Well, I'd say the disease comes on very gradually, and at first it was quite possible to do much of what we had done before with Tucker. But as time went on, the sphere of activity and the range of those activities became smaller and smaller. And so when we first came here, it was kind of be with Tucker and hang out. But gradually, as he lost his arms and his voice, things took a turn for a very different situation.
Although Tucker can communicate a paragraph through a single glance or through the sparkle in his eyes, his physical voice has gone silent. But we have his music. And we have the text of his words, which he sent to me in an email interview. They're read here by a narrator.
I have just about beaten the odds. 5 years is the upper statistical life expectancy for ALS, but I'm pretty much on schedule. At this point, I can flex my legs, a few fingers, and rotate my neck. My facial muscles mostly work. Swallowing became risky a year ago, so I eat through a tube in my belly. I haven't eaten anything in a year. Interestingly, this makes it impossible for me to watch commercial television. The simplest salad dressing ad is excruciating, and pizza advertisements are pornographic. I require mechanical aid to breathe, so I wear a nose mask 24/7. Perhaps the least attractive aspect of the disease's manifestation in me, for it has startlingly different effects in different people, is complete loss of control over my salivary glands. What with my total inability to speak and my incessant drooling, I'm often mistaken for a severely retarded or brain damage case. An unsatisfactory state of affairs.
Tucker and Lindsay, interviewed here in their late 40s, met as high school students in New Hampshire and have remained a couple ever since. Sometimes they work on films as a team at their home studio. At one point when their daughter Juno was an infant, her bassinet would lie between their editing rigs. ALS has changed the nature of their collaboration. Lindsay Mofford.
I was a wreck when I first, and couldn't believe it was true. And Tucker immediately was able to seem to process it in a much more spiritual way than I was able to.
What do you mean?
Well, I just immediately saw that the expectations I had, we just had a child, and we had been together so long that it was so surprising that I couldn't see what the future was going to be like. And I was not used to living day to day. I was definitely somebody who took care of stuff today, but was always looking forward to tomorrow. So I'm the kind of person who's working on a job, but thinking about where we're going to go on vacation. And this immediately put a halt to that. And when you're sitting there and a doctor tells you that your husband has 3 to 5 years to live, it's like, But then, and I realized that the only way to survive through that shock is to stop and to look around and say, wow, we have today. And it, in a strange way, after so much time together, it's really, you could almost say it's become more beautiful. You stop and you just look at each other, and I'm not running around as much. And Tucker's definitely helped me in that.
How?
Because I've watched how he's processed it. And it being facing death. And there's no way around it. That is what he's doing. Tucker has always been incredibly brave. He's always been sort of the courageous one, both physically and emotionally. And to watch how he has handled this, I'm in awe. And I think one reason so many people have been drawn to him since he's gotten the diagnosis is that they're in awe of him because he is so taken this, and he has not taken it as with pity. He has taken it in a strange way as a gift. Not that he wants to leave this earth, but seeing that this is a time for him to really search spiritually inside. And it's sort of teaching all of us to stop what we're doing in this crazy busy world and just breathe and think about what's going on inside us and what we could be and who we should be and what's really valuable.
Lindsay believes that by not succumbing to the depths of despair in the face of a fatal prognosis, Tucker has actually lengthened his life. I asked him about that in our email interview.
It's a mystery to me. It's a secret. Perhaps I'm not interested in despair. I have had previous experience with despair. It's a bore. Maybe I want a universe where I am brave. I'm not facing anything that all of you won't eventually face, and that everyone hasn't always faced. That may seem like cold comfort, but when I consider all those that went before, I see how I can go on, how I can do it. I'll tell you one thing. You can't fight despair. You have to let it pass through you. Plus, one of my superpowers is denial.
As he loses an ability, for instance, until a couple of months ago, he could use his fingers still pretty easily. Not the way that we can, but he could make some movement with them, which means that he could control an electric wheelchair. And he could control buttons to do certain things for him. And as he's lost that, then he suddenly will go to a dark side for a little while and say, oh. And as he says, he feels more and more like he's a brain in a jar. Or he said to me the other day, is my robot done that you put my brain into?
I assume that was a joke.
I think it's still a struggle for him. I think it would be impossible that it wouldn't be. I think he's come to terms with it emotionally on one hand, but then when he looks at our daughter, he gets crushed. There's no way around it.
10-year-old, beautiful girl.
So I think it's also, it's hard to know where the line's drawn between where he accepts it because he's at a certain place spiritually and where he accepts it because he has no other choice.
You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment with Tucker Stilley, please check our website, humanmedia.org. On the day I visited Tucker's home near Los Angeles, a group of more than a dozen friends who've pitched in to look after him had gathered for a party. A few were seated near the lemon tree in the backyard.
I've never actually met somebody quite like him, and it seems like every time someone has a terrible condition like this, they always become instantly canonized. But, you know, when I heard it was Tucker that had this, my first response was, oh, why does it have to be him? You know, but it really hasn't changed him. The only thing that's changed is the pace is different. Everything has to be slower, you know, and that sort of, for the rest of us anyway, if you're not having to deal with what he's dealing with, isn't bad either. You come over and it's even more relaxed.
Well, we're all a little bit too speeded up in our culture anyway.
And it's, you know, it forces you to really slow down because if for him to communicate, it just takes him physically a while to respond. But you kind of come now and you just go, ah.
Everyone is a little astounded at how Tucker masterfully works the computer through slight movements of his neck. He calls this using his head. Through graphic software, he created a mind-blowing comic book about his journey, which he titled The Permanent Record of New Jack Rasputin. Though laced with keen, ironic humor, wrote the Los Angeles Times, it is a tale of existential proportions. He produced a wild video showing how he interacts with the computer. You can link to these through our website, humanmedia.org.
Just the miracle of technology in the last 5 years has come so far that we actually get...
And how smart he is and how he sought it. I mean, he's...
Yeah, half the stuff he figures out.
When he found out he was ill, he's the one who sought out all the help he could to help himself.
Stay engaged with all of us, too, and stay engaged with the world. He knew the tools that were available and figured out how to master them so that he can be with us.
As Tucker's needs have increased, one sacrifice that ALS has exacted from him is anything resembling privacy. His brother-in-law, Eric Mofford.
It is hard for him to always have somebody there, even though it's required at this point that somebody comes in and watches over and makes sure that the tubes are where they're supposed to be and things like that.
The breathing tube.
Yeah. I mean,
coughing, the breathing, the hands. Yeah. If he's comfortable, if he's not comfortable, is his computer DOP down a little bit so he can't get a reflect going, so he can't itching?
Yeah.
All the little things like that. That needs 24/7 care right now.
The one thing that I've realized is that how wonderful and amazing the brain is, and Tucker's brain is 100%, and in some ways even more creative than it ever was, even though he's always been a creative guy, because he has a lot of time that he is able to use that brain, since he's not using, you know, the body functions to do the things like wash dishes or things like that.
Tucker Stilley.
I always had a very noisy mind. But as I lost my voice, my thoughts became very clear and very loud. There was nowhere to hide, so to speak. So I finally really started listening. I cleared the decks. I was forced to take myself seriously. I quickly learned I had to trust myself. Time was put into perspective, and I became playful and decisive. I had been creatively paralyzed when I had all the time in the world. Now, time was my medium, and I could judge it accurately. There's a curious time travel side effect that really got my attention. I've heard a couple of other ALS people mention it. It's quite vivid, and when you connect the dots, there is a feeling of purposefulness. As far as what I feel purposely focused on now, I must sadly report that I have encountered difficulties, and I am at another crossroad. Feeling quite overwhelmed. I've simply got too many open projects, which is fine, but they aren't integrating properly. When I am stopped cold in my tracks by the disease, I have to think my way out of it. Every turn of the screw, I have to do more with less. I am glad that I'm writing this interview right now, for example.
What's that? I think everything's good. The oven's still on.
You don't need it.
Tucker Stilley readily acknowledges that his ability to remain engaged with others and creatively vital hinges on the extraordinary collection of friends and family who take turns caring for his special needs. His brother-in-law, Eric.
My sense is that we've found our roles as friends that we do for Tucker and Lindsay. And I think that, you know, we're all gathered here today kind of to enjoy this moment with Tucker. But most of the time it's one or two people now that come and spend some time with Tucker at one point, because it really is overwhelming. There are people that sort of fell off at once Tucker was sick, you know, and there's some of those people who have come and become, you know, even stronger friends since he's been sick, that you see more than you did before he got sick. I actually think of myself not necessarily as much a caretaker for Tucker as a caretaker for my sister and her daughter. I mean, I sort of see that as my role, is to kind of sometimes just help her to go out and see other friends away from the house at times.
The bigger the group that's taking care of him, the easier it is on the caregivers as well, because there is such a group of people helping him that it's, and there's, and more all the time, that it's, it gets, it's getting a little easier as opposed to a little more difficult. I mean, it's weird balance, because Tucker, as Tucker gets, degenerates more, there's more people coming around, you know, I think crucial people to help.
I'm an engineer by trade, and by education, but I'm not really pursuing that currently, because it would be difficult to do both. Essentially, I just try to, you know, live life to the fullest for the moment. And at these moments, you know, I'm down here with my brother.
Philip Stille moved from Oakland, California to be part of the team helping to care for Tucker.
When he first was diagnosed, I had blinders on. It was difficult for me to face the actual reality of the situation. And I figured that my brother wouldn't want me to alter my course for his benefit, and that he would want me to just, you know, continue being me and doing what I wanted to do and pursuing my dreams. And it became clear, you know, maybe 6 months before I moved here, it became clear that, you know, I definitely had a significant role in the family and that I should be present, and that I was going to have to change my plans to make sure that he had every comfort that he could possibly have. And so that's what I've done.
Forgive me for being indelicate, but I can only assume that initially learning of this diagnosis and then watching the course of it had to have been nightmarish at first.
It still is. but you have to look at the silver lining.
Cynthia Stille, Tucker's mother.
We came out here. We never would have been near our granddaughter. And we never would have known Tucker or our other two children as adults as well as we do now. So that's been a good thing for us. I wouldn't have done it any other way, but to be here for him, it's hard to talk about it.
It has to be inspiring to see this whole community of people, the friends and co-workers and musician pals and so forth, who've just sort of come together and rallied around and become a kind of support system.
It is amazing, and it lifts my heart to have them all come over. A lot has to do with Tucker's wife, Lindsay, who has gotten together these people and not excluded them. You know, one of your natural reactions to this would be to pull away and just stay in the house and just try to hold it together. But she's reached out and invited everybody to come in and give whatever of their talents they have, and they are embraced, each one of the people that are here today. Her sister-in-law, Marisa, was the one who set up an email correspondence, a network with everybody, saying what we needed.
As you know, Tucker and Lindsay are very beloved, and people want to help. There's not been any lack of people offering anything, from money to hard labor to gardening to everything.
Tucker Stille.
I have experienced such an outpouring of love and generosity on all levels. Time, energy, technical advice, interest, moral support, good reviews and sales, outright cash contributions, benefactors and patrons, consider my mind firmly blown. My case is extreme in that it's so very blatantly obvious that everything that I do, every tiny thing, even the air I breathe, is dependent on the efforts of others in my behalf. Instead of a bittersweet after-school special, my life is more like one long barn raising.
Again, Tucker's brother-in-law, Eric Mofford.
The music that Tucker was doing ever since I've known Tucker, which is, you know, ever since he first started dating my sister when he was 16, was always out there and kind of experimental and stuff. And actually, when I go into his room in the studio and hear the music he's doing now off the computer, it's almost like the computers have caught up to what Tucker was creating 30 years ago musically.
At this jam session in the living room, a couple of musician friends are playing acoustic guitars and drums, while the electronic music is being created spontaneously by Tucker, whose head movements adjust the software on his computer.
What does going through ALS, however uninvited a trial it is, allow a person to see about life that might be harder to see otherwise?
Well, it's really cherishing each day.
Tucker's wife, Lindsay.
And there is something to be said about making somebody else your absolute priority. I mean, we, as a mother and as a friend to a lot of people and as a loyal film editor, many a directors, I feel that I already do, or one thinks that they do. But you actually have to get out of your own head, because you have to, the caregiving is so intense that you really can't be daydreaming in your own head, especially when you're with him. Because you can be really close to somebody, both physically and mentally, but perhaps you're still not 100% there. This way, you really want to be there. A, it might frankly be his last week. That's how intense this disease is.
Are you living with that perpetually?
Yeah I am. And to pretend that that's not intensely sad, I mean, that's the hardest thing. But because of that, because he can go at any time, there's two ways to go, right? Either you can be holding your breath the whole time and in pain, or just say, oh, well, let's see. It's beautiful out and he's beautiful. And look at him. What's he doing? He's not lying in bed moping about what's happening. He is ready to go and make a beautiful piece of art. So what the hell's wrong with me? I can walk to my computer, so I better start getting my work done, too. Or, of course, it's also helped that we both were kind of born optimistic, frankly. I think life is beautiful. And, of course, I'm lucky, right, because I can say that because there I was. I fell in love with – I met the man of my dreams at 15. I never went through a lot of the pain, a lot of people, the loneliness. I've never really been lonely, so I've been really lucky. And if you ask me what I'm most scared of about this, well, we'll see. My spiritual faith is love. And I think that that's part of what we're seeing in this community around Tucker. I've been to support groups for the people who have the illness and didn't have love around them. They left. They left the planet really fast. That doesn't mean they didn't have the money for a really great nurse, but it's love. So yeah, I have great spiritual sense, and it's love.
You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Kathy Graham. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Except for our theme song, all music in this program was composed and performed by Tucker Stilley. Special thanks to narrator Robert O'Connell, to Kate Stilley Steiner, and Tony Buck. Our program is produced by Human Media in association with WGBH Boston and The Network Incorporated. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN
and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment with Tucker Stilley is Humankind Program number 147.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, showing Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. The Case of the Three-Sided Dream tells the story of a multi-instrumentalist, Rashawn Roland Kirk, who went from a blind infant to a child prodigy to adult visionary to a political activist and finally to a paralyzed showman. Kirk was a seemingly superhuman musical force who played literally until the day he died. Again, that's The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The music playing is Interstellar Dub by DJ Mad from Portland's label Zam Zam Sounds. I'm Andre Middleton, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. I'll be hosting Art Focus on Tuesday mornings from 11:30 to noon on a bi-weekly basis, alternating with the incredible Joseph Galvan. Thank you for joining us. Today, I'll be interviewing Natalie Figueroa of YGB and Mia O'Connor from Deep Underground to talk about making creative spaces for communities of color and art as a verb. Can you dig it? But first up, some local art news. Last week, I stopped by the Hap Gallery, as I am wont to do, and I checked out a new installation there called Specular by local artist Damian Gilley. Tethered to a wall in otherwise empty space is a virtual reality headset. Full disclosure, I've never donned a VR headset before, so this is the first time for me. Once the headset was on and my eyes adjusted to the new environment, I was enveloped in a black room filled with geometric shapes composed of light. There were blues, greens, rubies. It was quite surreal, to say the least. Much like the holodeck on the fictional Enterprise Starship, I could walk around the virtual room and interact with the light constructs. Objects winked in and out of existence based on my perspective and orientation. It's a fascinating exhibit that is very reminiscent of Yaoi Kusama's Infinite Room. I highly recommend seeing this installation. That's at the Specular at Hap Gallery, 916 Northwest Flanders, open from 11 to 6 Tuesdays through Saturdays, now through July 9th. RAC has two opportunities for artists with deadlines coming up next month. First, July 6th is a deadline to submit your application for the RAC Fellowship Awards in Media Arts. The Regional Arts and Culture Council Fellowship Award Program recognizes artistic achievement and excellence and offers individual artists greater opportunities to advance their work. This program is intended to help individual artists of high merit sustain or enhance their creative process. RAC intends to award up to two $20,000 media art fellowships, depending on funding. So if you are a filmmaker, videographer, if you've been experimenting in the media arts as far as making either narrative or abstract or non-narrative work, please consider applying today. The second is RAC is seeking works on paper, print, drawings, photography, paintings, to purchase for the Visual Chronicle of the Portland Collection from today through July 25th. The Visual Chronicle of Portland is a collection of original works on paper that portray the artist's perception of what makes Portland, Oregon unique. The Chronicle is owned by the city, and since its inception, it has grown to over 320 works by 195 different artists. Works are displayed in publicly accessible spaces in the city of Portland and Multnomah County buildings. The collection strives to reflect the diversity of populations, artistic disciplines, and points of view. RAC administers this program. Please visit www.racc.org to learn more about both programs. Last up, Make Music Day PDX is an event for people who love music and the joy sense of community that music can foster. On June 21st, 2016, they will have 13 public parks and several other venues showing local music. Make Music PDX is a celebration of music for all genres, played by and enjoyed by people of all stripes. They'll present music from alternative to bluegrass, classical to Zydeco, hip-hop to country. Did I mention that it is free and all ages? You know how I like all ages stuff. I'm going to be heading over to Gabriel Park in Southeast Portland to check out Aviel Benyamin and a stellar lineup of hip-hop. Visit MakeMusicDayPDX.org to learn where there will be a concert near you. Well, once again, let me thank and express some real appreciation to my guests today, Mia O'Connor and Natalie Figueroa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Great, great, great.
Honestly.
Before I get started, let's give a quick hit to our audience about what is Doug and what is YGB. Mia?
Well, go ahead. So Deep Underground is an artist collective and series of events. Our mission statement is channeling discontent into creative outlets. So any type of discontent that we have with like things going on in the world or in Portland or in our community, we kind of use the events to share that creatively.
Great. Natalie?
Beautiful. Yeah. YGB is what our tagline is: more than a party, it's a community. And so we are also a collective of Black and Brown artists in Portland who come together to create parties that are not only a healing space, but also a place to really let loose. So good music, but love.
Now, I have to say, I have attended both of your events numerous times. Right, to call them parties is an understatement. There are literally... it's art as an experience, whether you've got a live paint, where you've got people doing spoken word, people dropping ciphers, mm-hmm. Whether you have community activists participating and spreading the good work and connecting. It's life affirming. It's just an amazing experience. Amazing. So before we go even further, let me get a little bit of your background. So Natalie, I hear you're from the Chicago area.
I am. I am from Chicago, the North Side, not the area, but the city.
The city. So. I stand corrected.
Shy till I die. So, I'm from Chicago. I moved to Portland about 7 years ago. I've been an activist since I was 14. Mostly around sexual health, HIV education, and then growing up in Chicago, being brown, being poor, there's no way that you cannot address segregation, police brutality, violence, all those things. So from a very young age, I bared witness to all of those things and worked really hard to fight against them.
Great. So. Now, Mia, you're homegrown.
Yep.
Local. Mm-hmm.
Portland native. Mm-hmm.
Give me a little background. Give us a little background.
Well, I was born in Portland, and I started dancing when I was 3. I kind of have been doing arts and creative things my entire life. I went to an arts middle school, Da Vinci, in Portland, and I graduated from Grant, Jefferson Dancers, for 4 years. And I think, like, my goal as of late has been just, like, planting my roots here and having a space and having a community that is mine still after school programs and things.
Outstanding, outstanding. So so to both of you, it's interesting to have two powerful women who are in the same circles and who are turning things up. But I imagine you both have maybe different circumstances, different background experiences. Mia, tell us some of the background that led to you wanting to birth this event.
I was living in a collective like house with a bunch of artists and sharing space with one of my best friends, Medina. And we were just always constantly throwing ideas back and forth, talking about revolution and art movements and things like that. And so it was just constantly on my mind. And then I hit up one of my friends to do an open mic in the basement of our house because we were gifted such a magical space. And so I just threw an open mic and it grew from there.
Nice. Now, Natalie, did you attend events like this back in Chicago?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I actually used to organize with a group called the Leftist Lounge, which they started in the Bay. They moved to Boston. They came to Chicago. And so I organized with a bunch of folks in Chicago to throw these events. So I've always been a part of collectives of people. And going out in Chicago, the house scene, the hip hop scene, the art scene, like I love Portland, but I longed for that. And so here I would meet these really beautiful creative people, especially folks of color, and then we never had places to be together. And so finally I was sick of it. I was sick of going to like terrible parties with terrible DJs and, you know, the co-opting of my culture and my art. So I just sat with my friends and we were like, we got to do this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. I'm going to jump around a bit. Deep Underground, YGB, and I'm going to give a shout out to my man, Bart Fitzgerald, who runs Legendary Mondays over at Swift. Remind me of the party slash art scene of the late 70s and mid 80s. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. So, you know, I got to hear about these crazy stories of things happening at the factory or things happening at Danceteria all over the city. Pushing boundaries and reconnecting with creatives and like-minded people on the regular was the foundation for the explosion of creativity that came out of that scene. Can you speak on how a similar scene for predominantly people of color is thriving in such a city like Portland? I mean, it seems like a paradox, but it is thriving. Why do you think that's the case?
Absolutely.
Well, for me, I think it's because a lot of us locals feel this sense of gentrification as like an urgent need to come together. It's a sense of urgency, and people are moving here to be a part of the art scene that they think that we have, which we do. So I think us coming together is just like, it's the flow of like why.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say as the transplant, not a gentrifier, as the transplant, seeing the strength in the community here, right? All these, so for me, I'm 33. I had a difficult time making friends when I first moved here because everybody was like really young and like going out and I wasn't really with that. And then one day I woke up and I was just surrounded by all these amazing like 19 to 25 year olds who are all from here, who either just moved back from school or are coming back in from the numbers because their houses were taken away from their families and now they're reclaiming space, you know. So I had this beautiful combination of folks, grown folks who I know who are coming here from New York, Chicago, LA, who wanted to do something, and then access to this beautiful community of young artists. And so for me, I was like, we have to make sure that we can bridge this and we can see how we all have shared experience. So I dealt with gentrification. I dealt with being pushed out. I dealt with people owning my art in Chicago. It's the same.
Right.
Those communities, we deal with the same thing. It just happens on different levels and it looks a little bit different. So in Portland, my goal with all of this and where I feel like I can add the most support to this is bridging some of those gaps between those communities because they're here and they're doing it.
And just that reminds me, I mean, when you mentioned your age and I'm in my late 40s and you're in your mid 20s.
22.
And it's incredible to think about the 20s. Intergenerational impact and aspect of this.
Absolutely.
I mean, there is an amazing cross-generational flow of information, flow of experience, where we're not siloing my experience. You know, I mean, I had a bunch of people over to my house a little while ago and I sat back. I was like, wow, I feel blessed that I can share my resources just as if it's knowledge and information. And unfortunately, for many people in the past, there has been almost a gatekeeper aspect to the power that people have attained. And I'm thrilled to see that I don't feel that now. You know what I mean?
Thank you for that work, because that's a lot of you, too, making sure that we're feel connected. Yeah, every time I'm like, Andre's here, what's up? Yeah. So that's real. There's a duty that is held by the folks who've been doing the work for a long time and the people who do have access to that information to share it. And there's a duty on our behalf as the younger people to create spaces so that we can have places to use those resources, you know? So there's a job that's being done by both of us. And I agree with you. What I love about Portland and why it feels so magical to be here right now is because everyone that I talk to is like, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm done with gatekeeping. I'm done with blocking people out. I'm done with throwing shade and I'm done with hating. Like, we are in this together. I'm going to support you. I'm going to love you. And as long as you're real with me, I'm going to keep loving you.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. It's incredible.
It's amazing
yeah.
to hear like young hip hop artists, to hear young men say like, thank you for creating this loving space, and, you know, I'm down for you, whatever you need. Like, that's massive.
It's, people come into the spaces and they really feel it, and it's good to see that people are acknowledging it.
Now, can you give me a little background of the journey that Deep Underground has taken since its inception? I mean, where did it start and where is it going?
It started in the basement, and it's going, like, we want to go global, worldwide, just connect. And it's great that Natalie has Chicago, like, we're able to connect that way, and then just we want to continue to grow.
Okay. Well, I was leaning into a plug for Dejecta right there.
Dejecta.
And the reason why I said that, because that was the first one that I went to. Mm-hmm. And I was struck at the wide range of shades in that room and the wide range of economic attainment in that room. I saw old, I saw young, I saw rich, I saw poor, I saw black, I saw white, I saw Latina, I saw LGBTQ. And what struck me was that, you know, 20 years ago, there are people in that room that wouldn't have crossed Lombard.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? There are people in that room that wouldn't have crossed I-5, you know, and it was, I think it was a testament to the power of art and creativity to really not just bridge gaps, but heal. Really heal. And that's something that what you just mentioned made me think about that, is where people are said, you know, I'm done. Mm-hmm. I'm done, you know, protecting my own, protecting my tribe. We're only going to keep moving forward in the face of gentrification, in the face of economic inequity, in the face of sexual inequity and gender inequity, if we really come together. And that's something I think is at the heart of both of what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me more. We've got plenty of time, but I want you guys both to tell me what's coming up next. I mean, you're on the radio. This is your platform. This is your stage. Natalie, what's happening next for you?
So our biggest thing coming up is our 1 year anniversary, which we are so excited about that it's been a year. So we're going to be at Holocene July 22nd. We're going to have Lamar Leroy, who is the most amazing DJ, and Akayla is going to sing, and House of Aquarius will be there, and Donovan, who is, if you've never heard him sing, your mind will be blown. We're also going to be doing, like, a really beautiful reception for the folks who've been supporting us since the beginning, specially invited. So everyone just got specially invited on the internet. And then the next thing after that is actually the collab with Doug for Pika for TBA. We are so excited. It is going to be absolutely amazing.
And
the space is incredible. It's raw. It's beautiful. We are going to take it over, and it's going to probably be the best night of the TBA after.
Yeah, definitely.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. That's
I'm
right.
Just going to put that out there.
That's right. Mia, how about you? What's on your plate?
So we have our summer session for open mic is going to be an open mic mixer, and we're going to do that at Service on this Thursday, and July.
That's like the day after tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Timing is right.
It is. It's so right. And then we got one more on July 14th, August 18th, Dejecta, our third quarterly event there. Is going to be July 16th. That is going to be amazing. I have a performance at Poetry Press Week on Friday with Donovan, and he'll be singing. He is phenomenal.
Folks, even though all the information isn't up on our website just yet, it'll be updated by this afternoon, so you can hit the links and figure and just hear all that. In fact, next time, write it down. Just have a pen. You know, when you listen to our focus, you're going to be getting the news. So make sure you write that down. So who as individuals or organizations have been invaluable in helping this movement grow for you, Mia?
A friend of mine, John Erland, he introduced me to some of the folks from the Paul Allen Foundation, Modu Dang, who introduced me to the people at Dejecta.
I know Modu. He's a good man.
Yes. Such good people. I have so many angels on my shoulders. Also the Doug team, Medina, Mulu, Vincent, Betty, Janessa, Xavier.
Next time we're going to have to fit them all in this little room next time. Next time we have to bring them all down, Natalie, how about you? I mean, I can only imagine the heavy lifting that you've been doing. Who's been part of that?
You know, it's really interesting because I think maybe because I wasn't from here, I don't have that kind of support, like in terms of connections to organizations, right? I do now. You actually have been incredible. I'm going to give you one more shout out because you have been instrumental in making sure that, like, I know what's going on in terms of, like, these other grants and all of that stuff. So, and really fueling that fire of knowing that we can go bigger. But honestly, it's been just the YGB team and then everyone who keeps showing up. Like, so Lamar LeRoy is amazing. Why can't I think of everybody's name? Renee Lopez. Oh,
Miss Lopez Media.
Honestly, Renee, she from the get was just like, what do you guys need? Do you need a booth? Do you need this? Do you need that? I got you. And she told everyone to come through and they gave us the benefit of the doubt that it was going to be a good party based on her rep. So I have to give like all praises due to Renee. And she connected me to the Doug folks. And like, and from that point on, it's just been us working hard to really make sure that the community keeps loving us.
Great.
And coming back.
Great. Yeah. I've got to give a big shout out to Renee Lopez as well. A couple of weeks ago with the coalition I'm working with called Friends of Noise had an event up in St. John's, and she came down. Not only did she take pictures, but she mentored some young female photographers just to give them the down low on how to do contra photography, how to take pictures that are vibrant, that are alive, that really express the energy that's happening. And I mean, she's a time traveler as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. She just, you know, she's amazing. And you know, if you need a photographer, she's an amazing resource. She's got so much skill, so many connects. You can't go wrong. You really can't go wrong. Well, we got about 10 minutes left. So in addition to these specific events, what other art do you do? Where can people see your work? I know that you dance. I've seen you in music videos. I've seen pictures of you dancing on the shore, dancing in public spaces. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that side of your career.
Well, I've just had dance and movement my entire life to express. I think that's my best way of getting my feelings out as opposed to talking sometimes. Yeah, it's just how I talk and how I feel, so it's my best way of expressing. I draw. I am really interested in, like, expressing through music, just because I'm around so many musicians. I'm just continuing to grow as an artist.
Now, did you do a collaboration with Shayla Lawson recently? What was that all about?
That's what's happening on Friday.
Gotcha.
She is having some of her poetry read, and I'm going to be dancing to their singing and music, and it's going to be really cool.
Outstanding. Where's that going to be at?
It's at Disjecta.
That's at Disjecta.
For Poetry Press Week.
Gotcha. And Natalie, how about you? How do you express yourself outside of bringing people together and just basking in the amount of love that they produce?
I mean, I'm not really a... That is my art. So,
for sure.
Loving the people and making sure they have a place to be
for sure.
is absolutely my art.
I have to admit, when I was putting together the show page for this, I scanned through a lot of the photographs that Renee and I'm sure Donovan Smith has been putting together for the YGB page on Facebook, where people can find you both, right?
Absolutely.
YGB Portland on Facebook and Deep Underground, which is Doug on Facebook. Mm-hmm. There's a book in there. I mean, the amount of love cross-generational, the amount of brown, the amount of fashion, the amount of just people being woke and alive.
Yes.
There's a book in there.
That takes a lot of work. I'm going to be honest with you, especially in Portland. I was telling someone, in Chicago, I would never have to throw YGB, right? YGB is Young, Gifted, and Brown. It's named after Nina Simone's Young, Gifted, and Black. Like, you know, we... In Chicago, as jacked up and segregated as it is, there's space. But here, we had to do a lot of work to make sure that we reached people, right? So, like, curating those events and really making sure that those people felt safe and loved and listened to and adjusting the event so that we could make sure that it stayed for them. That to me is my art.
I heard that.
Listening to people and then turning it into action.
Wow. Great. Well, we are going to be wrapping up here in a second. Once again, If you haven't heard about Deep Underground and YGB, now you have. They are amazing events. If you're down, if you're woke, if you've been walking a path alone and you've been looking for people we're all walking our paths. And these are two events that bring people together that not only provide fellowship, but provide a sense of safety and space. You know, before I go, I want to give a big shout out to friends and family in Orlando. That was messed up. And it's events like these that provide the energy to counter that kind of hatred, that kind of violence. That's all I can say to that. And I didn't want to let this broadcast go without giving a shout out and send some love out to those in Orlando. I can't thank you both enough for joining me today. I really can't. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow and the day after tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. I feel blessed to count myself amongst your community.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So to recap our art news, Specular at Hat Gallery. 916 North of Flanders, open 11 from 6, Tuesdays through Saturdays, now through July 9th. I believe there's going to be an artist talk on July 5th. Check that out as well. July 6th is the deadline to submit your application for the RAC Fellowship Award in Media Arts. July 25th is the deadline to submit your work for consideration for the Visual Chronicle of Portland. So all my 2D visual artists, if you paint on paper, take pictures. Renee Lopez, we're talking to you. Pictures. Please go visit the RAC website and check out the call for artists in that. June 21st will be Make Music Day PDX for people who love music and the joy sense of community that it can foster. It's at parks all over town. Wallace Park, Gabriel Park, all over town. Hey, you can find photos, links, as well as all the guest info on our show page. That's at KBU.FM/ArtFocus. Please follow the link to our Facebook page and like KBU Art Focus on Facebook. If you missed any part of today's show, there will be a podcast of the show online later this afternoon. As I said before, it's my goal to meet and introduce the listeners of KBU to a broad spectrum of regional artists. If you're a visual artist in any medium, I'd love to have you or your organization on your show. Don't make me call you. Call me. When I learn about residencies, grant deadlines, call for artists, you'll hear about it on this show as well as find it on our Facebook page. We're going out to the music of Danny Skrilla from Portland's own Zam Zam Sounds. Thanks again for joining us on Art Focus, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.